three, two, one. Let's begin at the beginning with FAQ 1, the poster, which appears in the movie film. Brought by you.
Yeah.
When you were asked to do a poster, it was your second ever job, wasn't it? Your first job was to do the something for Nick Franks for a mixing desk.
Actually, yes, there were. That was still at college. It was third year, 70... Gosh, it must have been 77, 78. Yeah, I did something for Nick Franks, which is a mixing desk company. I did something for a clothes store in Knutsford. But funny enough, for a man who then became the first loft developer in London very soon afterwards, New Caledonian Wharf.
Hmm.
And there was the poster, which was third term, March, April, third term of art college.
You were still at college.
Yeah.
And you approached me at a Patti Smith concert.
Yeah.
Can you remember what you said?
Ah, well, okay. I actually don't think I did. My version of it.
Yeah.
My version of it is that being at college alongside Malcolm, who was already working for the Buzzcocks and beginning
Malcolm
with magazine.
Malcolm being Malcolm Garrett.
Malcolm Garrett. Yeah.
Yes.
I was envious of this kind of real place work that Malcolm was doing. I mean, the punk and the new wave scene was the single most important thing to us at that point in time. That was the kind of pop culture, you know, epicenter of you know, young person's life in Manchester. And Malcolm was doing the Buzzcocks, and I was jealous. I was at college with him, with a desk next to him. He was doing this real stuff, and I was kind of stuck doing college, you know, briefs.
You didn't like your colleague. I actually met by pure chance, interviewed your professor about 3 weeks ago, who said that the first job you were set, you were so annoyed, A, you refused to do it, and B, you rang up your school to complain about the college.
I don't know.
You did?
I don't know. I doubt it. The only genuine anecdote, the only true anecdote that I can tell you about Manchester Polytechnic, now Manchester Metropolitan University, is that it's one of the only colleges in the UK, and having now spoken in colleges around the world, my own college is the only one that has never invited me back to give a talk or a presentation. And in fact, when a journalist inquired about that 10 years ago as to why they had never invited me back, the official college response was that Peter Saville is considered an unsuitable role model in this college, and that's why we haven't invited him back. So
that's Manchester Metropolitan, formerly the Poly, and its attitude.
Even though I was became external assessor for the degree for the college down the road, my own college
doesn't want to know.
Doesn't want me in the building.
It's punk. It's post-punk.
Yeah.
Your best pal at college, Malcolm Garrett, is doing the Buzzcocks.
And
you're jealous.
Right. What used to happen? Yes, I was envious, jealous, but you know, not so much. I kind of wanted to sort of do something as well, and the person I would pester was Richard Boone,
manager then of Buzzcocks.
Yes, and at a television, the television gig one night that we all stayed for because we went to see Blondie, but hung around to see who Television were. After the television gig, I went to Richard Boone and said, Richard, do you have anything yet? Is there another thing? Have you found another group? Is there some work I can do through you? And he said, well, no, not yet, but go and see Tony Wilson, because I've heard he's thinking of trying to organize a club night. And everybody in Manchester knew you indirectly. And I had that kind of vague link to you through Alan Brackey, a photographer who'd done some pictures for you once. And he said, well, just phone Granada. So through Alan, I came to see you. And in fact, I met you in, the refectory of Granada Television?
The canteen at Granada where you brought some books. You brought your book. And the main book you showed me was Tischold.
Mm. Jan Tischold. Because I didn't feel that I had actually done anything. I didn't feel that I had actually done any work which was representative of what I wanted to do. So I thought, well, all I can do is show Tony something that I'd like to do. So I bought I brought along Jan Tischold and said, this is kind of...
Jan Tischold, who is a Hungarian?
He was probably kind of... He was probably Swiss and one of the typographic designers of the modernist movement.
And a hero and the man who redesigned Penguin in the 50s.
Yes.
All those green, white and green books.
Yes. And so, he was a kind of one stage removed from the kind of slightly more hardcore constructivist early modernist look which Malcolm had been kind of employing and reinterpreting for the Buzzcocks. And Tischold was one step removed from that, cooler and kind of, more sophisticated. And when you're at college, you never really want to tread on the toes of you know, one of your fellow students. So I felt I had to look somewhere beyond where Malcolm had gone. And Tischold was, for me, the place to go beyond.
Then, having looked at the book, Alan Erasmus and I asked you to do a poster for these four nights of this club, which Erasmus had called the Factory.
I'm glad you mentioned the four nights.
Why? Because you got the picture, you got it ready by this third week.
No, I think because it must have covered at least a month. Well, was it every week or every 2 weeks?
It was every Friday night for 1 month.
So I don't think I was a month late.
No, you weren't. You were just 2 weeks late. It arrived halfway through.
Oh, well, that's okay then.
Yeah, you just missed the first two.
So, not exactly as portrayed in the film.
Yes, in the film, it's the first night, you arrive, it's late.
I know, but the thing is that the sort of quintessential point is that usually a poster is a sort of one-off event rather than a whole kind of month of events.
So now you're blaming me for having four nights and not...
I'm just pointing out that, yes, it probably was, I can't remember, but it probably was late, but probably not entirely uselessly late. Maybe just 50% useless.
Do you remember the great, wonderful tour photograph book for a New Order tour of America, which was a 43-date tour?
Yes.
Can you remember on which of those dates that book finally arrived at the merchandise stores?
That's a different topic, but...
37.
Good.
Good. Okay, so it wasn't
but
good enough.
But a very, very, very valuable possession for anybody who happens to have one now.
It is, actually. It's fantastic.
It's, but it's very valuable.
As was the Factory One poster, which was an event.
Even
what,
more valuable.
What made you do yellow and black squares?
The yellow and black was inspired by NCP car parks.
What?
NCP car
parks. You didn't tell
me
that. That's a bit low life.
Well, I might have told you, but... And you might not have remembered, or I might not have told you.
Well, you didn't
it wasn't
me.
Necessarily. I mean, it was, you know, it was a sort of, as far as I was concerned, an industrial music venue. It was like the new industry. It was a new sound industry. And it, I mean, you know, you decided to call it the Factory, or you and Alan had called it the Factory, which was actually a nice name. And the way that's played out in the film is actually really great. Factory closing, why not factory opening? I actually think is really lovely. The problem with it being called the Factory was that it was kind of the connection with the Warhol Factory,
which hadn't even occurred to me.
No, I
know
it was dangerous.
Very
no, but it did to me immediately, and at that point, in a way, sort of dangerously cliched.
Yes,
that wasn't the motivation, and it was the kind of the concept of factory opening is actually very nice, but the notion of it being Factory, as in Warhol Factory, was, you know, in 78 a bit uncomfortable.
Passé, yes.
And so I felt that I had to put a different spin on it, to put it in the context of industry. So it was quite deliberately hard-edged, and the colours were industrial colours. And they happened to be NCP car park colours. That was the yellow. I remember it very clearly in my mind. It's like NCP car park yellow is the kind of yellow I want.
When I came round to your flat in Altrincham to try and get the fucking poster out of you and it wasn't finished yet, it was on the floor and you had, I remember, pieces of yellow and black cardboard and you were kind of almost like a jigsaw but of square pieces and you were playing with them. Do you remember that?
I do. That was actually fairly responsible for a youngster. I was sort of recognising that it was a poster. And
what else might have been? A hamster or something?
No, it's very difficult designing posters. There was a great art once in poster design. And posters are designed to work from 10 or 20 feet away or more. They're not things you hold in your hand. There's a lot of poster design that happens now on a Macintosh. So someone's designing something for a sort of street or urban situation, but they're designing it
with intimacy,
1/6 size on a screen, 6 inches from their face. It's actually the completely wrong way to go about a poster. And even the way we worked in the 70s with sort of paste up on a drawing board actually isn't really the right way to go about a poster. It's a bigger scale than that. It's a bigger visual scale. And it was reasonably responsible for me to have it on the floor with bits of paper and step back from it and try and sort of think, look for something that was noticeable. I mean, there is a kind of graphic strength to that poster, which is noticeable. The failure is that you can't read the type. unless you go up close, if you go closely to it, you can. But I couldn't quite bear the idea of it being a sort of overbearing assault of information. I kind of just wanted somebody to notice this thing, and that if they connected with it, the kind of the visual codes of it, they identified, then they would be interested, and then they would come up and see, what is this about?
Last question on fact one. In the movie, a very nice line, which is inserted by that scouse bastard Frank Cottrell Boyce, where I'm apparently, being a pretentious twat quoting people, I say that William Morris made out the point that nothing useless is entirely beautiful.
Mm.
How do you feel about that line? Nothing useless is entirely beautiful.
The one fault in that line, really, is that the whole purpose of a piece of art... not that I'm comparing fact one to art, but the purpose of a piece of art is to exist in its own right. And art is entirely non-functional. That's the point. If it has a function, we find it difficult to relate to it and understand it as art. The whole point of a piece of art is that it doesn't do anything. And as soon as it does something, then perhaps it's...
commercial art.
Or design.
Fact two. Fact two was quite similar in the sense that you kept the blocks of colour. You kept blocks of black and a straight colour, which was silver and black.
Uh-huh.
But you added a new aesthetic in there, didn't you, on fact two, the factory sampler.
Mm.
Which is, what would you call those symbols that you returned to with Gay Dad many years later?
Oh, the kind of industrial icons. There is an industrial icon on that first poster, though, which is the Use Hearing Protection Man, which came from a workshop door in the art college. Perhaps that's why they've not invited me back.
You took it.
I stole it. But then someone stole it from me from the Corner House Gallery a few years ago. Every day on my way into college, past a 3D design department workshop door, I would see this Use Hearing Protection sign. And I thought it was great. And actually, after I met you and you said, do the poster, I did have to go and prize it off the door.
You took the head
yeah,
off the door.
Okay. Took, had to. I mean, now I would know that I could have found it to kind of reproduce it in a sort of industrial kind of equipment catalogue. But I didn't know where to find it.
You were too young.
Days, too young to know that. So I did borrow it off the college door and kept it. But anyway,
and then
it got stolen again. Someone stole it from the gallery.
Everything you steal then gets stolen again, which is quite nice, really.
Quite nice. So anyway, we carried on with those icons. Fact 2 is done in that style because there'd been a couple of posters done in between that first one and that first release, and the posters had already stepped off in a different direction, but we felt that... this record, or this kind of compilation EP, represented the club, and that the kind of graphic identity of the club had been set by the first poster. So I kind of went back to the style of that first poster for the sort of generic packaging for that first release. And I sat with you and Alan one day in Alan's flat when you put forward the idea of releasing a record. And I quite selfishly said that I thought it was a great idea, purely because I wanted to do a record sleeve. I mean, it could have anything on it.
In fact, it did have anything on it. John Dowie comedy tracks were a bit extreme, yes.
And I said it's a great idea, I mean, just selfishly, because I wanted to do something other than a poster. But it's quite a nice sleeve. It's sweet.
Well, it's a very nice sleeve. Let's move forward to a real one of your first classics, which is the Joy Division first album, Unknown Pleasures. And this is the only Joy Division New Order release, is it not, where the group really came up with the image at some point?
Yeah, it happens with groups anyway, with first albums. First albums, they've been thinking about.
Sad bastards.
For some time.
Yes.
You know, they've been, yeah, I mean, quite understandably, you know, and I mean, they've been sort of longing for this moment. I mean, maybe, you know, the last 3 or 4 years of their lives have led up to this, you know, while we're making an album. And they've thought about everything, you know, and particularly the cover. And Joy Division had with Unknown Pleasures. They had somehow between themselves collated what they wanted for the cover. And they gave me exactly the material. They said, this is what we want on the front. This is what we would like on the back or the inside, and this is the colour we want, etc. I kind of rearranged the order slightly. I think they wanted a white cover with a black motif, and I ended up making it black with a white motif. And I mean, I just kind of slightly adjusted the details, but it was essentially what they wanted. The funny thing about Unknown Pleasures was that really the only thing that I'd kind of really heard of Joy Division, I probably had seen them one night at the club, but all I really knew of them was the two tracks on the sampler. And I seem to remember that moments of one track were kind of listenable to. And I did the sleeve because it was an album cover and I wanted to do an album cover. And I went to Rob's house one afternoon, I think with the artwork. There was a quite particular reason that I went to Rob's. And when I got there, he said, oh, we've got a test pressing of the album. Do you want to listen to it? And I was really stuck. Because I thought, oh no, I don't know if I can face 40 minutes of Joy Division. But I couldn't say no, because, you know, I had been at least given the, you know, the honour of having done the cover. I mean, it would have been terrible to say another day. So I sort of summoned up a look of enthusiasm and sat down. Within about 20 seconds, I knew that I'd been involved in something really important. It was unbelievable. What had happened between the factory sample and Unknown Pleasures, what Martin had done to Joy Division, was just mind-boggling. I mean, it was amazing. And by the time we got to the second track, I just thought, wow, this is the best album of this moment in time that I've heard. I haven't heard anything like this for many, and I knew what was going on. I mean, I bought a lot and was aware a lot of what was going on, and it was amazing. And I listened through one side, and I just sat there and with this kind of incredibly sort of complacent feeling, because I thought, wow, by kind of default, I've done the cover of what will be a really, really important record.
Which it was.
Yeah.
We're very privileged and lucky.
It was. It was kind of like a privileged feeling there.
Yeah. Whose decision was it? Last bit. There's two bits about the album. Something that you won't be able to see on the DVD or feel is the actual texture of Unknown Pleasures as it was. Now, that was your doing. The group didn't say...
I think
say,
it was, but I
the group didn't say, here's some really expensive cardboard we can print it on.
I don't... It's a really interesting point there, Tony. I really don't know. it was a textured, it was a grain, we grained the paper and actually gave the thing a kind of a tactile quality and made it, gave it a sort of an object feel. I mean, it was only one color, it was black. Actually, without that grain, it was danger of being a kind of slightly bland and sort of cheap thing. But the graining transformed it into a thing. And actually, I actually can't remember whether I thought it would be a good idea to do, or whether Stephen Morris or Rob or somebody might have said, do we have to have flat paper? Maybe somebody might have prompted me and said, look, can we do something? I really can't remember, but it's what transforms it.
We were kind of already into the no expense spared mode, weren't we?
Mm. See, the point is that my relationship with that work was kind of removed from the sort of musical experience. It was quite interesting that I'd done the cover for Unknown Pleasures before I heard anything. What I was doing was not to do with the music. And I mean, in a kind of lovely sort of altruistic way, because nobody was doing this for business, and because nobody was running a business, I was left with remarkable freedom, which I can't even say I took advantage of it, because at the beginning, I didn't actually realize that it was freedom. I mean, a few years later, even given such kind of latitude, I would have felt a sense of responsibility to my client and said, look, I am doing X, Y, and Z. Is it okay? You know, Z is more expensive than X. You know, are we fine about this? But rather like a kind of a sort of 5-year-old in a sweet shop or something. I mean, you're actually not even aware. You're not even aware that you're stealing. You're not even aware that you're kind of abusing the situation. You know, at 15 and you raid the shop, you know that you're getting away with something. But I was rather like an infant. Nobody asked me what I was doing, and I didn't see the need to tell anybody. Which obviously culminates in Blue Monday.
Well, let's go on to Blue Monday then, because Blue Monday, it has this famous thing for having lost 5p on every copy sold, which it did due to our strange accounting system. But the strange thing about Blue Monday is that you'd had the idea for Blue Monday and Power, Corruption and Lies.
Mm.
You'd had the idea of the flowers, which we'll come back to in a minute for Power, Corruption and Lies. You had the idea that the single sleeve would have this, what was your strange concept about colours and words?
Oh, colour alphabet. The single sleeve really is a giant floppy disk. It's a floppy disk. It's a kind of Klaus Oldenburg interpretation of a floppy disk.
But then why did it have to have this 5-colour printing on the outside as well as being a floppy disk?
Because I was thinking through Power, Corruption, Lies at the same time, and the identity for Power, Corruption, Lies was going to be the colour code. And having established that would be the identity for New Order and Power, Corruption, Lies, it did make sense that, seeing that Blue Monday was related, not on it, because that's how it was in those days, but it was related, that should be the kind of coherent identity for that whole body of work. So Confusion carries on the same concept into slightly different territory. Blue Monday itself is directly based on a floppy disk. I saw them at their rehearsal studio to show them some possible images for Power, Corruption and Lies. And whilst I was there, I kind of just looked around me and I picked up a floppy disk. And I didn't know what it was. It was just this really charming, small, black kind of vinyl square thing. And I said, wow, what's this? And Stephen said, oh, it's a floppy disk. I said, oh, it's for the sequences. Yes, it's for the sequences. I kind of knew what a floppy disk was, just never kind of, we weren't working with computers yet in the studio. And I said, it's great. And I said, well, can I have it? And he said, no, 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 that, not that one. But he found me a blank. And I left the meeting that day with a blank of a floppy disk. And I listened to some of the tracks. I heard Blue Monday in their studio. And then they gave me a tape with some stuff on and with Blue Monday on. And I mean it was not a great it was not a great test of my imagination to understand that actually the kind of the essence of Blue Monday was on this floppy disk. That it was, you know, Blue Monday Blue Monday is a sequenced machine driven piece of music. And electronic machine piece of driven music, and is in a way kind of non-human. And that obviously the heart of this machine music was this floppy disk, or the brain of it was the floppy disk. So to me, the floppy disk was Blue Monday. So by the time I'd got back to London that night, that was the cover. I thought I must make a simulation of this floppy disk to be the cover. So I had to fake a floppy disk, Tony. So that involved things that a sort of average 12-inch single might not involve. It involved obviously an outer cover, but it definitely involves an inner cover. And the floppy disks have a die-cut circle in the middle, so it involved a die-cut.
And a die-cut circuit.
Die-cuts all over the place, actually. I could have left it at that, but it would have had to be entirely black. Shades of black, expensive shades of black. But with no type on it, because floppy disks don't have type on them. They're not labelled, branded products. The only solution really was to use the colour-coded alphabet that I was developing for Power Corruption Lies and take that over, so it was just a piece of abstract computer coding.
Last question on that, which is... today, this morning in London, the second piece to camera for this show of mine, which I then cut and did something else, said, you know, I'm the person who famously has the biggest selling 12-inch single in British history, which lost 5p on every copy. Mm. How do you feel about being, and this is one of the most foolish things ever done in the music industry, how do you feel about being responsible for that?
I took my part in a catalogue of irresponsibility.
So you are taking...
You were the MD of a record company, well, part-time MD of a record company, that allowed a 7-inch single to be released. Its chance of ever getting airplay was zero. New Order were the group who thought it wise to release a seven-minute single. I mean, did they have any kind of working knowledge of the music business or of radio? That 7-minute singles, I mean, perhaps with the exception of George Harrison, don't get played on the radio. I don't even know if George Harrison's got played on the radio. They don't play 7-inch singles on the radio. Seven-minute singles. Singles released only in 12-inch format in those days weren't commercial items either. In fact, it was like commercial suicide to only release a 12-inch single. So to release a 12-inch, 7.5-minute single was a kind of double suicide, really, almost one of those kind of mass suicidal events.
So you thought, why not add my little bit in here?
Well, I just did exactly as everybody else was doing, plainly. I did exactly what I wanted to do. And... actually, I question the way it's played out in the film. I don't think anybody knew. I don't think anybody knew at all
how much
that sleeve was going to cost. Because I don't think anybody looked into those things in those days.
Let's go now to Fantin Latour. That moment before you walked across the grey rehearsal room that night into Steve's corner and saw your floppy disk. And you have to know that as you were walking across the room before you got there, I foresaw it all, like Teresa's
lights here.
I just realised you would see your first floppy disk.
Oh, right.
I knew as you were walking across the room, I had that moment as an epiphany. That was just shortly after you waved in our faces a postcard from the National Gallery. Mm. Please tell us about the postcard.
Okay. The album was called Power Corruption Lies, as we know. Martha was my girlfriend, was with me. And I just started buying postcards, and just that I liked. Gave up on the cover for that day. And one of the postcards I picked up was the Fantin Latour Roses, because I liked it. It was a sort of chintzy painting, and it appealed to me. She appeared alongside me and saw me with this, and she said, "Are you thinking of using that? Or you, are you?" And I went, no, of course not. I just like it. And I thought, no, these flowers, not for power corruption lies. And then, of course, I thought, oh, fine, yes. They're perfect. It was the perfect camouflage. The kind of romantic, 19th century romantic, you know, chintzy bowl of flowers was just the perfect foil to power corruption and lies.
Last little bit of that story, which is wonderful. So you wave this postcard at us. We all go, yes.
Hmm.
You then say, but we've got to go and photograph the real image now.
Yeah.
We then spend 4 months of our lives, me personally, getting...
Well, that's the best bit of the story, which I don't really know if it's true or not, but your anecdote is the best bit. What? Well, we couldn't get it came to pass that...
It came to pass that we actually... No, we got him in. I got him into Norwich Castle.
Oh, yeah, but yeah, not only that. That's the great bit. Well,
Trevor goes in, yeah. Takes the photograph. We get the photograph of the real Fantin Latour flowers.
Yes.
And then everyone, including you, decides you like the brown tint on the postcard
better.
Yes,
that's true. But the grey tint on the postcard. The best part of the story is that having settled upon this image and Bernard saying, yes, it's wonderful because there's some flowers in one of the songs, that's usually about as...
profound as our musicians get. Thank you, Bernard.
We couldn't get the picture. We couldn't get the image to reproduce. There should have really been no problem. I was very, very anxious about telling the National Gallery that it was for an album called Power, Corruption and Lies. That I felt would upset them. And it was one of the reasons that I went down the colour-coded route. I actually didn't want to write Power, Corruption and Lies on this cover. I was interested in the idea that it was rumoured to be called Power, Corruption and Lies.
Okay.
But we couldn't get the image because they had somehow, strangely, lost the reproduction transparency in the museum. Normally it would not be a problem, they would have made a new one for us, but they couldn't make a new one because the painting had gone on long loan to Norwich Castle. And I said, well, how long? A month or so, thinking I can get away with that. I usually do. 5 years. I thought, I can't get away with that. They won't wait 5 years for that one. Anyway, we looked into it, and it was not possible to go and take the photograph ourselves, and you actually managed to get
I wrote to an MP or something and said that it was, well, as a member of the taxpaying public, it was my painting.
Yeah.
Yes.
I might have got a good... Do you want my version of the story?
Your version, good. I like different versions.
My version of the story is that we were refused permission at all levels, so there was a pause, and after several weeks you interjected and said, what the hell is going on? I explained that we had really only agreed upon this picture and we couldn't get it, and it was in the collection of the National Gallery and we couldn't do anything. And my understanding of it is that sort of Tony Wilson went into kind of Granada Reports mode and spoke to the director of the National Gallery, and who obviously somebody had briefed on the situation and that there was a problem, and that you asked him who owned the painting. That he, on behalf of the gallery, was refusing access to us, and you said, well, fine, but who owns the painting? And his reply I heard was that he said he was rather kind of lost for words and ultimately came out with, well, the people of Great Britain own
it. Yes.
To which you reportedly said, well, the people want it. And confronted with that, he said, well, if you put it like that, Mr. Wilson, perhaps we can make an exception in this case.
It made a good sleeve. It appears in all the books, doesn't it? It's very famous.
It's my favourite piece of work. The juxtaposition of the historic romanticism and the kind of contemporary coding remains for me my favourite piece of work. It strikes, it's a balance, it's a kind of slightly uneasy balance between modernism and romanticism.
Right, another image very quickly. Again, groups after the first album don't give a damn anymore.
It's not that they don't give a damn, it's that their life changes so dramatically that they don't know what's hit them. That they don't have time for anything anymore. They don't have time for themselves. They don't have time for their families anymore. They don't have time to think. They hardly even have time to write songs.
Second album, then, they don't bring you an image, you bring them an image.
Second album, they're in Britannia Row in London recording an album, and the issue of what should we put on the cover comes up, and they're still trying to write, I would imagine, write the songs or put the music down, and already somebody is saying what's on the cover, and nobody's even had a chance to even think about it. So they came to visit me. Rob brought them around and said, we need to talk about the cover and we've not had time to do anything, so can you propose something? Well, put on the spot like that, because I expected them to come with some notion, and they didn't have a notion. So put on the spot, I kind of reached for something which I liked and felt was important at that point in time, which I'd seen sometime in the recent months. And I said, well, I feel, and I should put it, open the book and put it down in front of them. I said, for me, this is important at the moment.
The book was Photo Magazine.
It was Photo Magazine, which was published in those days, mainly in Paris. And it was a journal that would come out every 2 or 3 months and was a kind of resume of, you know, state of the art photography. And in there was a series of work, black and white photographs by a man called Bernard Pierre Wolfe, art photographer based in New York. And he had done these apparently real scenes, almost tableau, in a graveyard. But they were so remarkable and florid and over the top that you couldn't really believe that they existed. I mean, I'm still not sure if they really existed, because some looked like he'd faked them.
Were they carvings, or were they people covered in
dust? Well, that's the problem.
Dust.
I mean, the story...
We don't know.
No, as it's told, it's a remarkable cemetery in northern Italy somewhere, where there is a local kind of cult or obsession with grandiose family crypts and tombs. That's the story. Now, Anton Corbin says that he has been to this cemetery. So Anton is the one who would actually kind of validate it. Some of the photographs are difficult to believe. They really look like Wolf set them up and dusted people down and said, just stand still for a moment whilst I shoot this. I'm really not sure if they're real. But it's Italy, it's northern Italy. The craftsmanship and the skill is there, so maybe they were real.
For 3 months, I can remember you bugging me because you wanted to shoot those things as if with people covered in dust, didn't you?
Possibly. I mean, I'd already, by that time, I'd become friends with Trevor, and we were very interested in doing our own version of things, in creating things.
That's Trevor, the man who photographed the late Trevor Key, who did the Tubular Bell.
That was Trevor's first record cover, was Tubular Bells.
So you wanted to go and create...
Well, maybe we did. I can't remember. We might have done. It would have been the sort of silly thing that we kind of got excited about. But in the end, we did use the Bernard Pierre Wolfe. And the interesting thing was, I put the images down in front of them with no idea at all what they were doing in the studio. That Unknown Pleasures, which they'd selected themselves, suited the kind of hard technical edge, the kind of modern edge of that first album. And this was a neoclassical image. This was totally kind of neoclassicism, these Bernard Pierre Wolfe pictures. They were the difference between the underpass in Manchester in the iodine light and the cathedral. That's the kind of the territory that it covered. And I tentatively put them down and said, well, I like this at the moment. I expected them to sort of say, well, yeah, but have you got anything else? But they didn't. All of them kind of leant forward onto the table and started to turn the pages of the magazine and look at this whole selection of pictures, and they were fascinated by them. And within, you know, minutes, they'd sort of gravitated towards one picture and said, we like this one. I said, do you? I mean, I was thrilled. 'Cause it was just directionally, it was right. Because remember, my agenda was not... Well, it wasn't the music, because I couldn't hear the music. My agenda was something completely different. But it connected with them. And of course, Ian was there. And in those days, by virtue of being the writer of the songs and the conduit of the songs, You have to identify that person as your client when you work with a group. There's always somebody who's the client. And it's the person whose prime art you're servicing. So you couldn't do a Joy Division cover without Ian. It's the look in his eyes that you need. What anybody else thinks doesn't really matter. It's the person who has expressed themselves through this material that you are bringing a visual for. So if it's not right for the writer, it's not right. And Ian was there, and this is the strange thing about Closer. It made sense for Ian. Now, later, when I heard what he'd written,
it made sense to you.
I mean, even from the whole kind of the mood, the shift in the mood of the sound from first album, second album was enormous. There was a kind of grand melodrama to Closer. It is the cathedral. It is Manchester Cathedral. And of course, what Ian had written, and as you remember, I was the first person to comment on the cover that we had for that record, because the day that you phoned me to say that Ian had died.
Well, that's the most weirdest thing, because in a way, it was that moment that it struck us, oh my God, because the sleeve had been printed. Wonderful sleeve,
yes,
Closer.
Was,
yeah, the cover of the sleeve was a tomb. Grave, was a tomb with a weeping woman. And it was...
Great art direction. I mean, it was one of the finest bits of art direction by Ian Curtis. I mean, a great bit of art direction. I mean, he sort of, you know, he designed his own future.
But after he died, there was some point, 12 hours, 24 hours, 36 hours, where suddenly you go, oh my God,
well,
the sleeve.
Well, you called me, I don't know whether it was the same day or the next day, you called me. I remember, I know exactly where I was standing. It was a bit like when, you know, Mr. Kennedy died or whatever. You called me and you told me that Ian had died. We talked on the phone for a few minutes because I couldn't quite understand why it had happened the same way everybody else couldn't understand. It wasn't what anybody expected. And during that conversation, I thought of the cover. And I said, Tony, it seems a bit kind of crass to mention it at this point, but we have an album on its way to release, and it has a tomb on the cover. And you went, oh my God. And I said, you better find out what we're going to do. You better go and talk to them and find out, because if we have to change this, we have to stop it. And it came to pass that they said it's what we agreed together, and it's what Ian said he wanted. So we stay with it, and that's the cover. If it seems exploitative, then fine, but that is the wrong reading of the situation. The danger was that it would look as if we'd done it deliberately after Ian had died, which, of course, wasn't the case.
When did we care what people thought? The one that seemed to come, I mean, I just attribute it to you, but I'm sure you stole it from somewhere, you bastard. The stock shot aesthetic, and the three pieces we're going to talk about very quickly.
All right, okay, so my approach to the whole thing is like a shifting...
This is the last bit.
It's a sort of shifting program. It's a shifting program to do with fashion.
Yeah.
Okay. It's graphic design as fashion. It's graphic design within the shifting terms of popular culture. That's what it's about. So where we started in 1980 is, of course, not where you end up in 1990. By the time we get to late 80s, early 90s, the retrievalist revival period of the 20th century has already brought itself back round to where it started. So by the time you get to 88, 89, you're actually already back at the 70s. So neo-70s starts round about 89. It hits the high street with Gucci in 94, 95. But as a mood coming through, it's quite evident from the late 80s. I found that you could do neo-70s not by reproducing it yourself, but just by visiting photo libraries that were, by their very nature, so wrong they were right, which is one of Bernard's lines.
Yes.
Places like Image Bank, I mean, they have kind of sharpened up their act a little bit in the last five years to kind of have a contemporary place. But back in, you know, 10 years ago, they were just treasure troves, time capsules of imagery that was so totally past its sell-by date that it was groovy again. So in the same way that Tom Ford went into the Gucci archive to find what to reinterpret in 94, 95, I just went back, I just went to the image bank and looked for the material that just kind of just quintessentially defined the moment and then repositioned it somewhere else. So had I been doing a travel brochure for Palm Springs, nobody would have noticed.
No, that revival well underway. Which was the first? Was it electronics getting away with it, or was it the Hallucienda poster?
I think it's electronics getting away with it. There was a particularly laid-back sound to that, and the title getting away with it. And Neil was involved. Neil Tennant was involved. And there was a mood. And I listened to it, and when I heard the title, the first thing that came to mind was a sort of J&B ad from Playboy in the 70s. That's just, it's what it sounded like. It was like something that Dean Martin might have sung if he was still around and sequenced. And I thought, getting away with it. I mean, it's a glass of whiskey, isn't it? But it's a 70s glass. It's Playboy 1970 glass of whiskey. So like, where am I going to find one of those? Well, I'll find one down at Image Bank. And of course, they still got lots of them.
Then I'm walking down the corridors in Granada, and my boss, David Plowright, says, how's that club of yours, Tony, the Hallucienda, or whatever you call it? And I went running off to the club and went, hey, guess what my boss called our club? And everyone went, oh, that's great, isn't that funny? And I said, let's ring up Peter and get a poster.
Yeah, and it was especially, I think, Monday nights were dedicated Hallucienda nights. And I don't actually know who did this. I've got a sneaky feeling that a boy called Julian Morey, who was working with me at the time, I think he stumbled over the science photo library. Whereas all the other photo libraries were full of kind of retro cliches that could be reinterpreted, we found this place that was full of images that you'd never seen before. You could never have seen them before because they were shot yesterday by a man with a computerized electron microscope. And it was the photograph of an invisible piece of pollen, or the photograph of fluorescent liquid before it goes into a machine. And we started to look at things that they had at the Science Photo Library. And they were just mind-boggling. Totally mind-boggling. They were organic psychedelic.
And you chose what for this one?
A pollen spore.
A pollen spore.
I think organic psychedelic is the best way to understand it. It was, I mean, the Hallucienda, I mean, it's so evocative of, you know, the kind of 60s acid scene, early, the California, you know, the famous kind of Grateful Dead posters, the San Francisco acid scene. And what we found was the scientific, organic, futuristic version of weird tripping. This was tripping into a microscopic pollen spore.